So anyhow, Foucault had made this proposal based on these other math, lower cohomology, and all these things, which, you know, again, did find their way into Witten's topological field theory and so forth. And then Koncevich said, well, the reason there's a mirror symmetry is because this Foucault definition using the Lagrangian manifolds is supposed to be the same as this holomorphic definition on a mirror manifold. And if you look at this basic thing that they're computing on both sides, it really is the correlation functions of topological open string theory, which lead to the superpotential on these brain world volumes. So there is a lot of physics in it once you realize that these abstract things that Koncevich was introducing really are deeper in it.
So once you realize your D-brain, do you still need Koncevich?
Like I said, I've still been learning things from this paper, but probably I'm going to learn them all before too long. But what I'm going to, unfortunately, the moral of my talk will be that you still need all the other mathematicians, at least, yeah, and Koncevich, because I'm going to tell you answers to interesting questions in brains and N equals one field theory, which use all the more simple mathematics that this is based on. So, I don't think so. There's really no reliance on world sheet concepts.
Yeah.
Except for these, you know, I mean, the concrete thing here were these disk instantons, but they're just not tetal to anything. You know, they're tetal to classical effects. So, no, you would not see that from this proposal. So in essence, it's different from Schrödinger-Gauss's law. But what's also true, and I'll say some things like this, is that I think too literal a belief in special Lagrangian manifolds and their properties is also wrong. And the real special Lagrangian manifolds that appear in as brains and string theory, first of all, have major stringy corrections. And second of all, probably even the special Lagrangian condition gets corrected. And so you have to be very careful in what you infer from that picture. And the mathematicians that have been trying to make sense of Schrödinger, Allen, Zaslow, a lot of them say, I've talked to them, they don't believe it in the literal form that they stated it.
Because of the
figure of
fibers and
And so, yeah. Thanks. Well, I'm happy to be back at GP. So, okay. So I'll try to, it's much like a talk I just gave at Caltech, I'll try to make it more physical, but I don't know if I'll succeed. So the general outline, well, we'll be talking about D-brains on Calabi-Yaus, and so I'll give you some of the basic picture that people agree on, things involving special Lagrangian manifolds and A and B brains and so forth. And then the basic problem we're going to set for ourselves in this talk, and it's work with my students Tomu Thiel and Christian Rummelsberger, is to look at a concrete example, which is what you get by blowing up the C3 mod Z3 orbifold, and it's a non-compact Calabi-Yau, and try to figure out really what the spectrum of D-brains is on this thing. And there's enough, this is by far the simplest example, and there's enough mathematical results that we've already gone quite far, and we think a complete answer to that problem is possible. And along the way, I'll tell you various things from the point of view both of the orbifold limit, which is n equals 1, d equals 4 field theory, and how you find brains, and a lot of kind of interesting techniques for working with n equals 1, d equals 4 theories that were there in the math literature, and I don't think any physicist had known about. And then I'll talk a bit about the large volume blow up of this thing, which is some nice smooth manifold, which is usually called OP2-3, which means that the singularity in this thing got blown up into a P2 complex projective plane, and it's just some line bundle over that. So that's the only topological thing. And so the brains are just four brains and two brains wrapped in like the one here, carrying vector bundles, and the mathematicians classified the vector bundles on P2. So on this side, the answer is known, and you can look it up in the math literature. So I'll try to describe a bit of that. One of the morals of this is going to turn out that these two descriptions turn out looking different, but they are much more similar than we had imagined when we started this project. And then finally, I'll try to draw some general conclusions from that. And we have a conjecture about a general condition that answers the question when, for a given Calabi-Yau, is a particular brain stable at some point in moduli space or not, that we call pi stability. And this is still very much work in progress, but I'll say something about it anyway. Okay, so the general picture, well, we have these Calabi-Yaus, and famous example is the quintic in P4, and this is one example of the Fermat quintic with 101 complex structure deformation and one Kähler modulus, just the size of the P4, and then promoted to a complex thing, the B field on some two cycle on this thing. And so this has been studied in great detail, and we know how to calculate the primary physical quantity in type 2 string theory compactified on this and many Calabi-Yaus, which is the prepotential for one or the other side, depending on whether it's 2A or 2B theory. And in fact, there are prepotentials associated with both sides, but you can look at 2A and 2B and get vector multiples associated with either one. So there's an FC and an FK, and these are accessible quantities in supersymmetric theory determined by the periods on the complex structure side. So here we could use this to determine masses of BPS brains, which are things wrapped about three cycles associated with H21, H23. And then the central charge of a brain would be integral of the holomorphic three form over its three cycle. And I could also write some basis of periods pi and call that Q dot pi, where Q is a charge of the brain and pi is this basis. And so that's a famous old result in string theory, that at string tree level, ignoring string loop corrections, this guy is classically exact and cannot receive alpha prime correction. So then the other side receives alpha prime corrections and from world sheet instantons, but there's this beautiful mirror proposal, which for many Calabi-Yaus, including the quintic, there's this mirror manifold, and in the case of the quintic, you can explicitly construct such that the periods associated with this guy are the complex periods on the mirror. So here we exchange these guys, and we're just studying some appropriate complex structure moduli space of one dimension. And this was done in great detail by Candelas et al. In a famous work, and their results for this example were that this complex structure moduli space over here, which becomes this Kähler moduli space, is a Riemann sphere with three singularities. And I'm going into this into a little bit of detail because it's going to turn out that our example is very similar, and that's so that this is not a waste of time. And so there's the large volume limit in this Kähler language. There's a conical singularity named from its origin over here. And in language of the, I should say that these, of course, the natural cycles over here and the brains with, whose masses are determined by these guys, of course, are wrapped on even dimensional cycles. These are often called the A brains and the B brains. And so the conifold is, of course, distinguished by having one of these periods go to zero. And it turns out to be exactly the period of the six brain carrying the trivial vector bundle. So it's a funny picture where the whole space goes to zero volume, but all the cycles within it retain finite volume. This has been known for quite a while. And then, yeah, what can you say? And then finally, there's this Z5 or Geppner point, which you can realize concretely as a Geppner model at this point in complex structure moduli space. And there are some interesting things to say about brains on that, but that was.
Actually, you mentioned
that. Yeah.
The fact that the volume is zero on the subsector. Right. Is that really an unambiguous statement? Because if you go around this thing there, monitoring on what you call the volume changes in some other sense.
There is no preferred volume. There's just the masses of all these brains. And.
The one that started at six brains.
I'm just saying, let's just be, I mean, obviously, you can make the question as complicated as you want, but let's just do the stupid thing. Let's just start at large volume and go like that. Which one goes to zero?
And then you say, if you just go
that's the pure six brain, yeah.
Then the six brain is the one
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's because the dual to this thing is this particular S3 that is shrinking to zero. I don't think there is any classical six-dimensional picture. In the B language, I don't think there's any geometrical picture. Yeah, this is definitely where Wilczek instanton corrections are dominating. No, everything is stringy, of course. Yeah. Okay, so we have these three points, and now we can ask for what should we ask now? We're going to ask about brains. Okay, well, a D brain in this theory in type 2A or type 2B, I'm generally going to not care about the difference and always work in whatever theory allows me to put in a brain which wraps some cycle up here and then fills the four remaining dimensions of space-time. So I'm going to talk about theories that have a effective four-dimensional low-energy theory. And the reason I'm going to do that, basically, is, first of all, I can do it because I'm always going to talk about the limit of very weak string coupling. That's just my preference to understand that corner of the problem first. And then getting to the other dimensions is just a kind of trivial dimensional reduction at that point. So I might as well use this familiar language of D equals 4. And the maximal supersymmetry I can have is N equals 1, D equals 4. And that's something which would correspond to a BPS brain. Say if I'd consider something which looked like a D0, a particle in the four dimensions, it would then be BPS and preserve half the supersymmetry. So I can get such things which are BPS by wrapping these around particular preferred cycles, which have been analyzed. You know, these conditions were stated a while ago, and this one is very old. This is, you wrap the thing around a holomorphic 2P cycle. It carries a gauge field. That gauge field should not just emit a solution of the Yang-Mills, but what, you know, sometimes called the Hermitian Yang-Mills equation, which is the holomorphic piece of the connection is zero, and the 1-1 piece of the connection is proportional to the Taylor form. So let me get a little room. So holomorphic cycle plus bundle. And then on the A side, after Becker's triometer showed that the right thing was what they called a, I'm not even sure they called it in this first paper, but special Lagrangian manifold that is characterized by being Lagrangian with respect to the Taylor form. And the various ways of phrasing this, but one is to say that some theta, there's some imaginary part of the holomorphic 3 form possibly rotated by this theta that also restricts to zero. And then you can show that, well, it's kind of obvious from various things that the real part's going to, the real part of this is going to be constant, and that's going to turn into a minimal volume condition. And then all this turns out to be part of what's called calibrated geometry. I'm going to actually use, well, this is one of the points where the talk gets too long, so I may not go into this part in any great detail, but it turns out that the theory including these and a few other special guys like this was worked out by two mathematicians, Harvey and Lawson, and they're actually useful theorems in the subject for us. So I may get there. Okay. Well, I'm going to have to say something about that. Anyhow, this is the picture in the from the point of view of, you know, Bornenfeld or, you know, Brain Lagrangian without stringy corrections, from the point of view of the, you know, supergravity approximation to string theory. And a natural question is, well, what, you know, is this the right condition in general? You know, if I have a string scale collider, yeah, given weird things like that, well, who knows what's going on? And more appropriate or more useful comment along those lines is to realize that we are in a bulk n equals 2d equals 4 theory, and unlike the cases with more supersymmetry, these theories can have lines of marginal stability for the BPS states. And so as we move around in whatever moduli space controls the central charge, so for these B brains, the Kähler moduli space, say, we're going to cross these lines on which the, so I look at two brains, I look at their central charges, Z1, Z2, and as I'm sure you all know, they cannot decay. There cannot be any process of these two guys forming a bound state or one of them decaying into this plus another one unless these lines are parallel just by an obvious energy conservation. And these are lines of real codimension one in the moduli space, and these are lines of marginal stability. So there really is an interesting possibility for the spectrum to vary. And as we know, this happens in gauge theory, and not only does it happen, but in the understood examples, the Seiberg-Wooden theory, its many generalizations, the spectrum becomes simpler in the strong coupling regime. So if you look at the Seiberg-Wooden, there's the W boson, there's the monopole and all the dions that you make out of it with arbitrary electric charge and magnetic charge one. The moduli space is again a sphere with two singular points where the monopole and the dion become the assless. And there's a line going through them, and if you go through that line, almost everything decays, becomes unstable except that monopole and dion. So the spectrum is really much simpler down there. And so it's an interesting question. You can ask whether something like that also happens here. And so that's a prime. So I'm saying if we work out a world volume theory, it'll be n equals 1. But before we do it, we could add, well, we could say before we do it, maybe we should check that it exists. A slightly more specific question is to ask, well, suppose we find one of these theories and we cross one of these lines of marginal stability. What's going on? And the answer to this question, it'll turn out to be the general answer once I tell you something, which at this point is still a little of a conjecture, but I have a space-time argument, and I'm starting to believe this pretty strongly, which is that, suppose we establish that such a theory exists for some cycle. Okay, now what should we ask about it? Well, it's got some gauge group, it's got some spectrum. The gauge group, the matter lives in some representation, or in n equals 1, it's got to be chiral multiplets living in that representation of the gauge group. And then once we have that, we can start talking about the superpotential. And then actually, that's not the end of the story, even for purposes of finding the vacuum, because there are also D terms in the Lagrange. And in particular, for every U1 factor in the gauge group, there's some phi A Eliopoulos term that enters the potential. So the potential, of course, is going to have this generic sum of W prime squared plus sum of things that look like phi dagger phi minus zeta, sum over Q here, some quantity squared. So each U1 is coupling to these charged matter in its D term, and the supersymmetric vacuum will satisfy both W prime and D's equals zero. So once we know all that, then very generically, if we assume in particular that the Kähler potential, which would be the next step, is non-singular, we can figure out the space of vacuum. Okay, so this is kind of the minimal amount that you would like to know about the n equals 1 theory. And as the studies of gauge theory show, it's very hard to do better and say very much about this, which is not really directly protected by supersymmetry at all. But let's at least try to say something about this. Okay, so given some cycle up here, some combination of cycles, we could try to derive from it all this. Okay, and we could ask, are there interesting stringy corrections in this thing or not? And the basic statement I'm going to tell you about that is that once we get down to this level, I'm going to claim, let me write D and F for these two types of terms, that for A brains and, let me say B brains first, and A brains respectively, the F, the superpotential stuff, can only depend on where you are in the complex structure moduli space, and the D stuff can only depend on where you are in the Kähler moduli space, and then for the A, you better have the mirror statement. And then finally, I'm going to list below this the actual central charge and mass of the brain, and as we already reviewed, here it depends on MK, and here it depends on MC. So it's a pretty strong statement about the dependence of these various terms in this effective Lagrangian on the moduli of the Calabi-M. And it's confirmed in a lot of examples, both in the large volume and in the string U regime, and there's a space-time argument for it, which I'm basically checking with Nathan Berkovitz to see if there's any loophole, to the effect that the couplings that cannot happen in this thing are couplings where the particular n equals 1, which is unbroken when you stick in the D brain, pairs. Let's talk about the superpotential and the MK over here. The Kähler moduli over here are paired with Ramon-Ramon fields under that n equals 1. And so their couplings to the D brains are very constrained. Whereas the complex structure moduli just pair two NS fields, and so their couplings can be general holomorphic couplings. Okay, so anyhow, it's by far the simplest way things could work, and there's a lot of evidence for this point. How it works in practice, well, let's first talk about the large volume version of this problem. Let's talk about the B brain. Okay, so what would we do? Well, first we would find some holomorphic cycle, and you can, I'm sure, believe me that the problem of finding a holomorphic cycle only depended on MC, and the problem of finding these holomorphic bundles only depends on MC. And so that's to say that if I try to write some low-energy Lagrangian that governs that part of the problem, it should only depend on MC. And indeed, there are concrete examples. The simplest example, probably the oldest example, is actually this is a little confusing example. The one which really fits into this scheme is the problem of looking at a RAP2 brain inside the Calabi-L. So there's a result of Witten that he used in the context of MQCD, that the effective superpotential on such a two-brain can be derived by finding a three-brain B, such that the boundary is this omega, and then integrating the holomorphic freeform over that B. And I'm just reviewing, it's Witten's MQCD. You can check that this is extremized at a holomorphic cycle. And it's clear this is a superpotential that only depends on the complex structure. So that's an example of what I have in mind. So let's imagine we solve this part of the problem. Okay, well, now we got to solve this part of the problem. And here's the Kähler dependence. Okay, and so obviously we want to say something that looks like this. And if you look at now Donaldson's proof, Uhlenbeck and Yao's proof, there's a very clear discussion in Donaldson and Kernheimer's book. How does Donaldson prove his theorem? Well, you start with one of these, and it's a holomorphic object, and then you solve this thing basically by minimizing the Yang-Mills action. And you can think of this condition as a D-term in the precise sense that there's a natural Kähler structure on this space of gauge field, and this thing generates gauge transformations on that moduli space. So the relation between this and gauge transformation is precisely the relation between this and the complex gauge transformations, and the standard real part of that, which are gauge transformations down here. And so this part of the problem really is entering as a D term in this infinite dimensional sense, and it's very plausible it's going to reduce down to this finite dimensional D term subsector. And then if you ask, well, okay, what is it they're really going to reduce into? Do I really have to solve an equation like that? And the answer is, no, you don't, but you do have to check something. And the thing that you have to check is called stability, or more precisely, new stability of your vector bundle E. And this is where the talk starts to turn into mathematics, unfortunately. So I guess I'm just going to say the minimal that you'll let me say about this. I'm happy to say more. So what does mu stability mean? Well, you write down something called the slope, which I'll call mu, it's often the notation, and it's the first term class wedged as many times as it takes into the Taylor form, normalized by dividing by the rank. So that's a, you know, clearly a topological quantity. It wasn't quasi-topological, you know, this was topological, and then the choice of Taylor class entered here, but it depends on these finitely many parameters in general. And then we asked it for all the subbundles of E. So subbundle, we're really going to actually use this, means that there's some map, some homomorphism that will map sections of E prime into E that is injective. So this has to be non-zero. Okay. So all the subbundles have to satisfy mu of E prime is less than mu of E. And Donaldson proves that existence of these solutions is if and only if it's mu stable. And it looks kind of mystifying and peculiar. So we're going to actually, rather than spend a lot of time on that, it's going to turn out to be a very precise and simpler analog of that over here, which I think will be easier to explain. And, well, maybe say something more about that towards the end. Okay, so you do have something to check, and that something depends, again, only on the Taylor potential. And so the claim now is going to be that suppose we cross one of these, let's just postulate a line of marginal stability here, and cross it so that our BPS brain decays into something else, something, well, that depended on the Taylor moduli space, and something must be going on with the D terms. And there's this very simple model of what's going on with the D terms, which, so far as I know, was first pointed out by Eric Sharp, but could be before that because it's such a simple model. So the model actually is even simple. The simplest, the best picture is in the A picture. And this was pointed out by Kachuru and McGreevitt, okay, just recently based on a work of Joyce that I may get to. Anyhow, look at the A picture and look at two three brains and ask, does a pair of three brains crossing each other or doing something in this manifold, do they simultaneously preserve supersymmetry? And the answer is, well, no. They carry different, they are supersymmetric special Lagrangian with respect to different phases, theta. That's easy to show that this is also the argument, this theta is the argument of the central charge, just from that definition. So if z1 over z2, not real, they break all SUSY. Okay, and then as by tuning the angle between these guys, I can adjust them into supersymmetric configurations. There's another possibility, which is that when they break supersymmetry, there might be a tachyon in this spectrum. It might be that these things are unstable. And what should they go over into? They should intercommute, as Callan and Malvasina described for two brains, but it's physically pretty obvious is what they should want to do. Whereas if there's no tachyon, then that shouldn't be a possibility, and this should be the unique non-supersymmetric configuration of these two objects. So how do you test that? Well, if you're in large volume, you could take the very general problem with intersecting three brains and just look at the local neighborhood of this intersection and treat it like flat space. So you look at that, and there's a string stretch between these guys. And the mass of that string depends on the sum of the angles between these guys. And this is actually where the calibrated geometry comes in. It turns out that this is really, there's a precise theorem of this type in the calibrated geometry. When is a situation like this minimized to volume, or when does this instead minimize the volume? And that criterion exactly agrees with the string theory criterion of when there's a tachyon. Okay, so anyhow, there's a tachyon as a function of the angles between these guys satisfying a condition, which I'll quote precisely, okay, it's a little longer than it ought to be if I quote it precisely, but take your two three brains, consider a orientation reversal of one of those three brains, find there's some SO6 rotation between these two guys, and you diagonalize it, and it's characterized by three angles of rotation, which I guess I should call psi, performing with the notation in the theorem. Okay, then it must be that psi I, okay, the sum of the psi I's is greater than pi, then there's no tachyon. And if it's less than pi, there is a tachyon. you can imagine that sort of calculation coming out of string theory with twist sectors, certainly. It turns out to be the real geometric answer. And so in one dimension, it's clear that you're never going to make this angle greater than pi, and there's always a tachyon. But as soon as you get the two and up, it's possible to have these non-BPS configurations without tachyon, such as the zero-brain, six-brain would be a dual example to that sort of thing. Okay, so. Yeah, it really gives the right, the geometric answer for when there's, that's right. Yeah. Okay, so we have this theory, which is U1 cross U1, certainly in this separated brain phase, it's U1 cross U1. We have this charged matter. It sometimes goes tachyonic as a function of parameters. There's really only one way matter can do that in a supersymmetric theory, and it's through D terms and expanding around the wrong vacuum. So if you look at just this D term and you say that this dependence on the angles goes exactly through here, where phi is that field, then, well, there are three cases. So phi squared minus zeta quantity squared. Zeta can be positive, zero, or negative, depending on exactly this. And if zeta is positive, that means that there is a supersymmetric vacuum. You can just solve phi squared equals zeta, okay? It also means that if you expand it around the wrong point, the potential looks like this, you would see a tachyon. So this is actually the case with the tachyon. What the theory wants to do with this tachyon is slide down to here. That will break the gauge symmetry and get you down to a U1 theory, which is just this. So that's the one side of the story. And then you vary this parameter and you come over to the other side of the story where you cannot satisfy just phi squared equals zeta. And of course, the potential looks like this. And there is a vacuum, but it's a non-supersymmetric vacuum with U1 squared, phi equals zero. And that's the no tachyon picture. There's certainly no tachyon. The U1 squared tells you that there really just are these two brains, and they could not take advantage of this possibility. And then this borderline case is something that actually corresponds to semi-stability. Exactly when you hit the border in this condition, it turns out you always get an enhanced gauge symmetry. If you look at, in fact, we'll see this in our simpler example. And so semi-stable. And this is really the only model for this in N equals 1 effective theories. And so it supports this general statement that the Kähler dependence is always going to produce these, well, over here it was complex structure, you see. It was really these angles got encoded in. So if I write down the orientation of these planes, I can actually compute the sum of these angles by comparing this dz1, dz2, dz3 restricted to this brain, because each of these guys is going to be some e to the I, psi, sub I. I'm going to be saying that if the first brain is mzi equals 0, the second brain is going to be m e to the phi I zi equals 0. And so this is actually also the argument of the ratio of the central charges. And so you see on the A side this explicit dependence on the complex structure, and then this large volume discussion is this dependence on the Kähler structure, and they're mirrored to each other. Okay. Yeah. Right. So the question whether they're in a bound state or not in the particle case is exactly the question of whether the gauge symmetry got broken down to U1 or not, because of course the other positions in the three dimensions are going to be things you got from dimensionally reducing that U1. Right, so this one is a bound state because we broke to U1 and these guys are not. So each of these objects by itself can satisfy the BPS bound. Of course, this non-BPS configuration doesn't. What's the question? I mean, you can ask what. I'm sorry. Go on. Yeah. Okay, well, the BPS bound, checking the actual BPS bound now is going to depend on another thing, which is that the real potential is also going to have something else like this. Right, this is going to compute some explicit dependence, which doesn't really matter for purposes of finding the vacuum, but it's there. And we actually would prefer not to talk about the problem of calculating this f of zeta. It's not as constrained as the rest. So I would claim, indeed, if you, in any given context, you could calculate this carefully, but I would also claim that the essential information was already up here, and that whenever you find, well, a slight generalization, okay, so this is not the only way to get a supersymmetric vacuum, as we were discussing, because you could have theories that break n equals 2 down to different n equals 1 subgroups, and so you could get something where you don't literally solve this equation, but what you do is you solve this for some set of D terms, okay? So it's not always true that you can solve matrix, let me write it as a matrix equation, because that's what it is in general, and we're going to use those. I may have to repeat it when I use it again, but anyhow, you have a set of equations that look like this, and it's not a general statement. It's going to be a statement which is true in these deep brain theories. These equations are always going to really kind of look like this. Tough to say that all our objects are in bifundamentals because they're open strings stretched between things. And these are the strings coming out of some particular gauge sector and the strings going into some gauge sector. This is going to be clearer once I get under here with these quivers. But I'll just say it, and you can ask me to say it again when the time comes. Anyhow, if you take the trace of these equations, you add them all up and you get zero, and that turns into the condition that sum over all the gauge groups rank times Fi terms has to be zero. There's an obvious consistency condition to solve all the D-flatness equations. So what you can also do if you don't satisfy this is you can find solutions where you satisfy the D-flatness conditions with respect to some other set of Fi terms. And then those are really supersymmetric vacua under a different U1. And the way you see that, that's natural, is you could rewrite the potential like this, inserting this theta. And then because you've set this part to zero, it's obvious that this is really a minimum of the potential. It's a minimum with energy theta minus theta squared. So it's just got a constant vacuum energy. And then there's always a global U1 in the problem for these D-brain problems with no charged matter. So there's always a sort of extra inhomogeneous supersymmetry that just shifts that gaugino. And so any vacuum of this sort with a constant vacuum energy, you can actually make supersymmetric under a modified supersymmetry where you stick in this inhomogeneous shift. So this is actually just as good for the purpose of finding BPS states. Now I would claim this is it. This is how you find BPS states in these theories. And if you check this extra constant term very carefully, you would find that it did agree with the BPS bound. So you can make what you will of that, but I think I will. Yeah, that's right. There can very generally be different unbroken supersymmetries, and in this context of describing with D terms, this is how it shows up. Okay, so yeah. Right, in this mirror picture. And what's also very interesting, of course, is that the stability condition here in this A picture only depended on complex structure, so it didn't get world sheet instanton correction. So it really is consistent to just look at this picture and claim that that's the situation in the string theory on this A side.
The fact that that simple geometric criteria agrees with some sort of quantum string calculation.
What's such a trivial quantum string calculation? I mean, if they hadn't been true, I would have been greatly disturbed. But indeed, it's nice that it agrees. You look at the calculation and you'll realize what I'm saying. Oh yeah, completely different. So this is some question of adding up zero point energies of these various things. But you know, these zero point energies are linear in these angles. Yeah. And this one agrees in flat space. And then when you extend this to the Claudial, like I said, it's sort of conjectural, because I would start to claim, I'm going to very soon start to claim that any more predictions we draw from this picture are not always right. But this one hangs together very well. And this is going to be important later, because actually this is much stronger than it looks, if you believe this, because not only, you see, this not only tells you that the decay can only happen when this ratio became real. Well, you did that a long time ago. That's no big news. But it tells you that on which side of this ratio the decay is going to happen. So the case where there is a bound state and a tachyon is, I'm going to put this in terms of what I know is correct, in terms of the actual bound state. Well, suppose there's some z, the bound state is u1 plus z2. So this is the side, I mean, it's just rephrasing that same condition. It's just a kind of meaningless one that I stuck into the condition. But this is the side where the angles are in this relation. And conversely, this is the side where the angles are in the other relation. So you start to not just know that the decay is going to happen, but on which side the decay is going to happen, which is really not something you knew from general arguments before. Okay, so let's see. Is there more of the basic picture that I want to develop? No, I don't think so. So, are there any questions about that? Or? Okay, so now we'll get into our example. Okay, well, I shouldn't erase this, because it will turn out to be usable again, but. Oh, steady under stop, all right. Okay, well, if you don't want to do any algebraic geometry, the easiest approach to this theory is from this orbital fold theory, and I'm blowing it up. So I should say, though, this part of the algebraic geometry. So I just told you that you blow up and you get that. And so there's one Kähler modulus on the P2. There is a mirror to this, which the actual geometry of is sort of confusing. I did not get any clear statement about this. But you can really calculate what's called local mirror symmetry, the correct Kähler periods on this guy, and you find that the stringy Kähler moduli space looks exactly like this, and in fact even the labels are the same, and just that 5 becomes a 3. And so it's a sphere with 3 singularities. This theory has 0 brain and wrapped 2 and 4 brains, you know, just one, there's one cycle in each of these classes, and then it turns out again the pure 4 brain goes to 0 at this point, and then there's this point with this enhanced Z3 symmetry, which turns out to be the orbifold point. And now that, in some sense, is the most palatable, and the one that probably the most of you actually worked on, because there's this direct D-brain gauge theory construction where you start with C3 and you do the quotient by sticking in images and projecting to the, so this familiar business that I started doing with Greg. And the theory you get out of that has a gauge group for each representation of the group Z3. Well, there are 3 representations, so there are 3 gauge groups. They can be any rank UN groups in general. And then you calculate the spectrum by solving this, and you find 3 chiral moleplets and bifundamentals of each pair written like this, where this is what N bar, and they just 3 of them, because they're doing the same thing for all 3 transverse coordinates here. So that's a class of n equals 1, d equals 4 gauge theories that describes the general situation near this orbifold point down here. Well, it's got a superpotential, again, just induced from this construction, which if I call these guys x, y, z, it looks like trace x, I, y, j, z, k, epsilon, I, j, k. And it has d terms, and it has 2 independent by Lyapunov's terms, you can calculate from string theory that they sum to zero. And so there are two U1s with charged matter, and that's derived now. So there are two real parameters that, as we've argued, is the only thing that could express the dependence on the Kähler moduli. Unfortunately, the Kähler moduli space also has two real parameters, so it's very plausible. And again, you can calculate very easily a leading order that the twist field that takes you away from here in the orbifold does couple to these. It has more or less zeta k, which is m e 2 pi I k over 3 times a coordinate, local coordinate z around that point with some phase, which I'm probably going to get wrong, but we'll use that later. I'll put it in the right one at that point. So you can calculate this also from string theory. So the claim now, you know, from boundary state and all sorts of other verses is that this really does describe the whole situation if you just take BPS brains and not the anti-brains at that point. That describes all their low energy dynamics at least. So the question, well, this is certainly an example that illustrates my general, you know, principles. And now what is our question in this context? Our question was, well, okay, what are the BPS brains or bound states in this thing? And I just told you that bound state, I'm only going to talk about the small GS one again. So bound state equals classical supersymmetric vacuum under some n equals 1. So that means I allow these things where V equals constant. And you need, you know, a single, not some, you know, collection of bound states with unbroken J symmetry U1. So you might break to some, you know, arbitrary subgroup, but if it's bigger than U1, you're going to have lots of, if these are D0, say, you're going to have lots of extra moduli that lets you separate these guys. So that's not obviously not a unique bound state. So, okay, so that's the question. So it's just a mathematical question at this point. You take this theory for some given list of n's. They're all sensible theories of D0 brains. Wind up a vacuum with unbroken gauge symmetry U1. So it actually doesn't seem like such an easy problem when you first start looking at it for different, I mean, you can do it by hand, low ends and so forth, but there really is a general theory to some extent of this stuff, which gets called the theory of quiver representations to solve this problem of solving the F-flatness conditions over here, and then a notion of stability called theta stability to solve this D-flatness condition. So, okay, so suppose we're given some list of N1, N2, N3. So then there's either yes or no. And so we should first solve the F-flatness. And it will help you greatly in finding the appropriate references, and it took us a while to arrive at this point. If you realize that this is the problem of finding sure representations of this quiver, call the Z3 quiver, I guess, or people call them the K quiver. Yeah. Okay. So sure, representation just means that it breaks down to U1. And we're really solving just this problem of the F-flatness of XI, YJ equals 0, and all the other kind of, you know, two equations that look like this. Okay, so you look it up in F form, and you won't find the answer. Okay, but you will find the answer of some very interesting simplifications of that problem just by looking in the right place. And so there's a paper by Schofield, which very luckily for us, just about the starting point when we were beginning this project, that tells you how to answer this question for the case of, let's say, N1 equals 0. So you just have this theory because you lost that gauge group and you lost that matter. Okay, so you might say that's a pretty trivial theory. I know how to solve that one. And you would basically be right, but it helps you to have the right concepts to organize the solution. And so, well, what's the obvious thing to do? Okay, the obvious thing is to write down if there's some moduli space of solutions, then what is the expected dimension of that moduli space up to complex gauge equivalents? Okay, so that's really the natural notion here. You know, you're not going to can, obviously you can easily generate the whole gauge orbit under complex gauge equivalence. So this is what you're interested in. And so the expected dimension of this moduli space is complex is 3, N2, N3, minus N2 squared, minus N3 squared, plus 1. And that's pretty obvious. You're just counting matter. You're subtracting these complex gauge invariances. And then there's this overall U1 under which nothing is charged, so you shouldn't have subtracted that. And so the kind of naive thing that you would tend to say, if you're very naive, you would say, well, this had better be not negative, you know, because if it's negative, there's no moduli space. And then, you know, either no or 2 seconds of thinking will, of course, tell you that this is false. There can, of course, be a moduli space if you violate this condition. But what is true is that you're not going to get a moduli space of things that break you down to U1. The way you can, of course, violate this formula is if you have more unbroken gauge invariance, so that this piece of the formula was wrong. So it is true that if you insist that you break you down to U1, this is the right formula and this is the right deduction. Up here. You mean or this picture or this picture? So we just said N1 is 0. That means this is the group U0. That means none of this matter is there, but this matter is there. And then that means X and Z are 0, so the superpotential just goes away. Yeah, it's a special case of these theories where I take one of these. So all these are possible theories of brains at the orbifold point. So they're all perfectly good from world sheet consistency as long as you don't fill all three dimensions. It's just different choices of this representation. You leave out some of these images, you can say. These are fractional brains. This is a general fractional brains. That's right. This is the general question. What are all the fractional brains? Yeah, if that helps. They're all obviously constituents of the basic fractional brains. Now we're just asking, what are their downstates? And so the answer is, well, if this is non-negative, then there's a downstate. And it's not tremendously exciting in that form, but it certainly is important. And it actually leads to some useful conclusions, especially if you rewrite this formula in kind of a trivial way. But in terms of a matrix, but it's a Cartan matrix. And this is what's called the Katz inner product. It turns out that before the Katz-Moody algebras, Katz, I think, made a lot of his name by studying problems like this. And so he introduced this inner form, this inner product, and you can see it's what would be some sort of hyperbolic nasty algebra in the usual context. And probably it's right that if you look at quantum bound states in this problem, that algebra really becomes important, but for us, and the question here, well, there are basically, let's call this the inner product between, the length of the root, potential, charge vector in here, and then there are the cases where this is equal to 2, that's a root, that's the case where d is 0, and there's basically then the case where it's non-positive. And because of normalizations, it can't be 1. And this is d greater than 0. And then you have all the kind of geometry of reflections that you have in the Katz-Moody situation, where you can actually get all the roots by doing vial reflections of around a basic 1. So you have this inner product, and you write things like r goes to r minus 2 r, one of the simple roots, alpha i. And all this part of the theory is directly relevant. It lets you generate all these roots. The N2, N3 plane in this picture looks like this. So this is a regular region, which is like this. And then there are some discrete solutions that you get by these reflections, which are exceptional, p equals 0. And then there's a kind of obvious boundary where the ratio is 3. So the boundary of this region is where this guy has its negative, the eigenvectors of this matrix. So these are things like the ratio is 3 minus root 5 over 2 and 3 plus root 5 over 2. So it's just the math of this quadratic form. And so any lattice point inside here is one of these guys, and it exists. And then you've got this special list of points out of here. And there's actually a very simple recursion relation, where if you start with 1, 0, the next one is 3, 1, and 8, 3. It just comes from applying this. So it's very easy to actually list, in that sense, all these solutions. And then even better, you can actually derive. Suppose, well, certainly the 1, 0 theory is not tremendously hard to solve, because there's no matter. And then there's actually a sense in which you can derive the 3, 1 from the 1, 0, the 8, 3 from the 3, 1. It's a very simple mathematical construction that kind of tensors this. There's the 3, 1 is also pretty clear. If you let alpha be this gauge index and you have zi, then you just want to make zi alpha be delta I alpha. So that one's not hard. And then sort of tensoring with this guy, you can get all of them. And that's this viral reflection. So there's some sort of nice theory for these guys that at least, you know, I didn't claim it was the hardest problem in the world, but it fits the answers into a nice framework that we know has connections with other things. Of course, once, you know, this sort of thing that's more valuable is when we start looking at all three here. But the other reason why this has value is that now we have to, of course, solve the B-flatness conditions. And if all the zetas were zero, you would have this general statement that, you know, you can look up in the physics literature that you can always solve the B-flatness conditions. And it's also kind of obvious you can, in this particular example, you can never solve them breaking down to U1, because all these things are going to be zero, basically. And so the interesting solutions are the ones where you turn on the FI terms, and so you need some generalization of this statement. And it turned out that a mathematician named King had thoughtfully provided this for us, because he was interested in when these representations were stable and when you could apply symplectic quotient to get them. Okay, so there's this, you know, the same strategy for solving the D-flatness conditions that I described. You write them all out, xx dagger minus beta squared. You just flow to a minimum of this thing. And then the question is the minimum on the complexified gauge orbit, in which case there is a solution to the D-flatness condition, or in general, it could be that the minimum is not on the complexified gauge orbit, in which case that orbit does not contain the solution to the D-flatness condition. And the canonical example of that second thing is things like, let's just take the problem of, to be a little simpler, a matrix, a single matrix with an adjoint action. Then you know that the D-flatness conditions are this, but what goes wrong with things like this, where you turn on, so see, I mean, it's of course not true that you can diagonalize all matrices. You know, there's a matrix that you can't diagonalize. So what's wrong with that guy? Well, you know, you can't solve the D-flatness equations. But in the present language, the way you could see that you were not going to solve the D-flatness equations is, well, the way it's usually phrased in the math literature, geometric invariant theory, is that there's a one-parameter subgroup of the complex gauge group that takes you off the orbit. And it's just the appropriate conjugation here, something like lambda 1, lambda inverse 1. Yeah, so that's going to take this thing into 1 lambda z, 0, 1. And then if I take the limit lambda goes to 0, well, that's a perfectly good element of this group. And it takes me off of the orbit. And that's actually the limit which solves the equation, is where this is 0. So it turns out that the general condition is that there should be no one-parameter subgroup to this type. And then you can also reformulate that as the statement that there should be no sub-representation which violates a condition called theta stability. Okay, so theta stability, kind of look familiar, says that for every sub, let me move up, I guess. I won't use this again. So every sub-representation R prime of R, I didn't tell you what that was yet, must satisfy theta dot n prime is positive. So now we're going to actually solve the problem, you know, with the D-flatness condition. So we're going to insist on this condition that I derived for you before. We know that's required if we're really going to get a D-flat solution. And then it turns out that every sub-representation also has to satisfy this, or else the problem that I just described will happen. And so let's say sub-representation. Well, a sub-representation is there's some homomorphism from some other. I mean, there's some sort of intuitive picture of picking out some piece of this, which is the sub-representation, but it's not, you know, it's much better to give a precise definition. So here's R. So there's some explicit matrices ZI here, N2, N3. Here's R prime, and there are some N2 prime, N3 prime, and there's some choice of these matrices. And as we said, it doesn't really, all it has to do is break you down to U1. I mean, it's not even, you can show that, you know, such a thing would exist, one that broke you down to U1 in this case. And so you got those, and you have to be able to find a map phi 1, well, we call it phi 2, and a map phi 3, which are just N2 prime by N2 complex matrix, N3 prime by N3 complex matrix. It's really kind of a generalization of this idea of complex gauge transformation. So if I'd gone from R to itself, this would have been the complex gauge transformation, and now we're sort of allowing the same thing to go from R prime to R. So it doesn't have to be a square matrix, but we are going to ask that it behave like a gauge transformation, which means ZI phi 2 equals phi 3 ZI prime. So again, if it had been a gauge transformation, you would, you know, if these had been invertible, you could just invert and it would be a gauge transformation. And this is all kind of natural generalization that doesn't require you to invert anything. And so that's the definition of a sub-representation. It has to exist one of these, which is injective. So it's this thing that I wrote earlier on the board, and it generally is called an element of HOM R prime R, homomorphism, and these are in an abelian category and so forth. Okay. So the claim is that if you can find one of those that violates this condition, there will not exist a solution to the D-flatness equation. And the condition really depends on, you know, the thetas here in the first instance are these zetas. So the dependence is very explicit. And I think in this particular example with two, you do not find interesting cases where varying the thetas changes this, but that will change once we move on to three here. And it's the same, this is very general, this, you know, all these Clifford theories admit this theorem. Okay, so those are really the ingredients we want to solve this type of problem. So we have to solve the F-flatness, and we have some technology that helps us to some extent. And then the D-flatness we really killed. You know, if we can list all the sub-representations, then we can tell you. Okay, so now we can move on to the more general thing. So this is certainly something, and there was that link coming around. Now, very generally, as you all know, even with just the F-flatness conditions, generically you have the same number of equations of motion as unknowns. Of course, you have, you know, for every, you know, every auxiliary field, you have an equation. And so that means even before you start quotienting by the gauge transformation, the expected dimension of moduli space is zero, and then you apply a formula like this, and you find that the expected dimension of the formula is always negative. So just generically, there are no supersymmetric vacua. But always in real life, special things happen to make that conclusion not true. And in this particular case, a very easy way to make that conclusion not true is to choose one of these links and just set it to zero. And you can do it by hand, and you can also argue that for given choices of the FI terms, it's going to be very natural. So if the condition were, say, you know, y dagger minus z dagger z equals zeta, and zeta is positive, then it's really not going to get anything with you know, only z and not y. And anything that had z, I could try to turn it off. And anyhow, it's a very natural thing to do. And all this part is by hand, but we think we've proven that this is the only way to get solutions, except for the d0. You can see why the d0 is more general. The other reason why this is the right thing to do in this problem, not just, you know, something mathematical, is that this is exactly, if I had done the same thing to the D0, this is exactly the thing that would constrain it to live on the P2. And we want these other things to be wrapped on the P2, and we want the strings between the D0 and these guys to be massless only if it's on the P2 and so forth. And so this is really right for something that lives on the P2. Okay, so now this is a problem with fewer equations than matter fields. So it can have an interesting solution, and you can generalize this expected dimension formula. And I'll just write it out. And it's just the same type of thing, except that you subtract a term for every superpotential condition. So it's 1 minus 1 half n vector 2, 2, 2, and 1 to 2, and then the superpotential. Okay, so that's the expected dimension of a moduli space in this problem. And again, the statement is that this had better be non-negative if you're going to get a sure representation. And again, this is a pretty strong constraint. And so we can go on from there. And it starts to sound like an interesting kind of abstract problem. And you do get some picture of the, you get a very clear picture of the brains. Once you get to this step, it starts to be very tricky. Okay, and the reason that we know that it's very tricky, and yet we know something about the solution of this problem, in particular, even finding now all the roots, you know, where the dimension is zero, is tricky. And so this is the plus 3. This is the one that came from the superpotential. So this is to say that I lose a 3 for every one of these relations, every set of these relations. So I lose n1 times 3n1 n3 from satisfying that. Okay, so now, okay, all this is kind of math. Okay, but now you imagine we work on this problem, and now we want to, obviously, we were learning about what the answer in the large volume was. And the first thing you need to do to make any contact with the large volume in this is you have to know, well, what are the charges of these fractional brains in the large volume? So if you just go up this path in moduli space, there's some definite answer of the charge of each of these brains. And this was worked out by Giaconescu and Gomez, using the same local mirror symmetry results. And it's not hard. And so the answer is that one of these guys on one end is the Kerr-4 brain, the guy that, before I say this, I can just say something which is an important point of the talk, which is that although this is, because this is a very general answer to the problem, it's also very easy to show in specific cases that for certain choices of these FI terms, the spectrums are going to become a lot smaller. Okay, so in particular, let's suppose I had to reduce down to this quiver, and then this zeta had been negative. Okay, so I was left with YY dagger is minus zeta. Okay, well, that's something that doesn't have any non-trivial solutions. And everything over here just splits off. Okay, you're going to have some minor marginal stability. Each of these fractional brains is going to be unbound from the other one. So if you started with one of these states, and then you varied the zetas from plus to minus, that's, like I said, there were no non-trivial examples of this, but the trivial example, which is really quite important in this physics, is that, when theta crosses from positive to negative, obviously you're going to lose lots of states, and it's just this. And what that tells you is that if you go around, so varying these zetas is basically going around a little circle around this point, and as you come from this line coming at a large volume where you have a maximal spectrum very similar to large volume, you head off to this line to the conifold, you're going to find that most of those states go away. And the typical spectrum at a point right here will be, say, 0, 0, 1, and then let me write it in the same notation I used over there. It's trivial, but I have exactly the N2, N3s that I had over there, and I'll have 1, 0, 0, and I won't have any mixed states just because of this FI term. And so that's really an example where the spectrum of brains really became much smaller the way it did in the Seiberg-Witten theory. And it didn't become finite. It didn't reduce only, so this is the brain that would become massless if I had it out. It didn't reduce only to that brain, but it became that plus some other simpler infinite set of brains, which I completely described for you. So that does answer that question that I started with already, that the spectrum of brains does become drastically reduced at appropriate points in the strong coupling regime. But you have a lot of interesting structure around this point, which is what this condition implicitly tells you. Okay, so now I come back to this large volume story. And what are these brains in the large volume limit? Well, one of them was this pure four brain that became the ancillus there. Another one turns out to be the four brain with a two brain flux turned on, exactly the thing you would get if you went like this to B plus one to the four brain. And that's usually called O minus one, and this is called O in the math literature. So this is just the trivial sheaf of holomorphic functions. That's to say that, you know, the Dirac zero modes are just constants on that P2 of that forebrain. And then this is the thing where I turn on one minus one unit of magnetic flux, and there are actually no zero modes on it. On the other hand, if I'd done O1, that would be the thing where polynomials of degree one and those usual homogeneous variables are sections of this, meaning there are three zero modes of appropriate chirality there, and so forth. So anyhow, those are two of them. And then they all have to add up to the zero brain, and then you can infer what the other one is. And the other one turns out to be T star one, which, well, this was a four brain, this was a four brain, so this guy has to have four brain charge minus two. Actually, I should probably call it that because of this minus. So star is dual, it's not complex conjugation or something. Anyhow, this is, say, it's an anti-brain. This is the dual to the tangent bundle. This is twisted once like that. I'll just list its charges, which just directly follow from what I said over there. So these guys in some convention have no zero brain charge, and so now it adds up to a zero brain, and this cancels that minus one two brain charge, and this cancels the two four brains. So they computed this. And so now, given any N1, N2, N3, you can figure out what it's supposed to be in the large volume limit and what these guys are. Okay, well, that's a star. Well, Dyak and Eskimo and Gomez checked that, indeed, all these three guys are stable bundles in the large volume limit. And so there's no contradiction at all with saying, you know, just continue them up. And there was really no way they could decay to anything in this diagram, so that's a good thing. And there are other interesting things which do not have a nice picture in this diagram, such as the pure two-brain. So the two-brain is N1 equals 1, N3 equals minus 1, and N2 equals 0. I just cancel off the four-brain charge between these guys, and I'm left with two-brain charge. So that's a guy which looks kind of problematic down here. And indeed, it's true. If you follow the two-brain period down, it actually goes to 0 down here. And it's sort of a confusing point in the literature because at some points it said that there's a B equals a half there that you might have thought would be relevant. But it turns out, I checked this with Albert Klemm, it's not true. And the two-brain would have gone nastless there. And indeed it decays as you cross a line up here, which is easy to calculate from these other considerations. So it's a question of conventions. I mean, there is certainly a correct convention in which B is a half, and I'm not arguing with that. But if you really work out the mass of that two-brain, it would go massless down there, and it does cross a line of marginal stability. Oh no, it's going to be different in K3. Yeah, yeah. No, the analog there is clear, as even in my papers. There certainly is the B is a half, and one over n, and so forth. And I'm sure, in the sense it was claimed in the literature, it is true that B is a half. But if you look at the mass of this two brain, well, a way to see the reason is that this two-brain actually has an induced zero-brain charge because of a normal bundle. The normal bundle is twisted here. And you can say that that's why it's massless. So it's conventions. But the convention-independent statement is that it would have become massless there, and it does decay before it gets there. And it's good. You know, it did not make a lot of sense in this picture. And that's a couple of comparisons. So we obviously got an infinite number of things to compare if we're going to make this comparison between the list of states here and the list of states here. And now here's the thing which really surprised and impressed us, which is that in some sense this diagram was already there in the math literature long ago. In fact, it was in the math literature in 1976 because this is what's called the Balanson monad. So there is this canonical construction of all the bundles on Pn even, and for P2, it's exactly this. Okay, you take three vector spaces like that. You tensor them with exactly these three bundles. You postulate some matrices X and Y that satisfy this. And then the kernel of this mod the image of this, which is this usual linear sigma model construction, gives you the bundle with those charges. And it's a way of getting all those bundles. And so that's the meaning of what I led up to, that these two descriptions are really a lot more similar than you would have thought going into this game. And so it really is not at all hard to imagine some continuous process where you carry these guys down there, and you're going to describe what happens to them along the way by some generalization away from the Ogleful point of this stability condition. And the idea of subobject, well, these stability conditions really are very similar. Okay, this was a precise idea of subobject here. There's an idea of subobject in the context of these vector bundles, which really mathematically is the same thing as this. And so there really is the beginning of a picture that could make sense over the whole Taylor moduli space. And the general, if you really follow this general principle that I tried to justify for you in the beginning of the talk, it actually had better be that there's some sense in which you can solve the F flatness conditions and find all these holomorphic things in some sort of a uniform way, not caring what the Kähler structure is, and that you then carry these guys around under some stability condition that tells you at a given point whether they exist there or not. And I think it's an appropriate point to mention the conjecture, which is still very conjectural, and it's still sort of a process of trying to make a statement that makes sense, okay, as to what that condition could be. So, okay, so it's going to be some stability condition that includes both of the ideas of stability that I told you of, the mu stability and the theta stability. And so we have something we call pi stability, because it depends on the periods pi of the Calabi-Yau and the central charges. And to say, for every, first you solve the F flatness and you find these guys, and this was some holomorphic relation that just makes sense given the solution of the F flatness condition. The subobjects are prime. For every subobject R prime in R, we're going to ask, in the first instance, okay, I'm going to modify this a little bit to get my current form of the conjecture, mz over z prime, which equals m q dot pi over q prime dot pi, has to be positive. Okay, so that's to say that something is pi stable, and the claim would be that, if this is true, that will exist at that point with periods, Kähler periods pi. And so the first piece of philosophy here is that I combine the A and the B pictures. I really kind of use mirror symmetry because I'm really sort of calculating these periods using the A picture, right? These are the things which got quantum corrections on the B side, and they were classically exact on the A side. This is even the condition which I told you on the A side came out of this analysis of Joyce and so forth about when do special Lagrangian manifolds decay. So it seems very well motivated from that point of view. But what is this subobject thing? Well, if you looked at Joyce's picture, you would be very tempted to say, and we said for a long time, whenever two three-brains intersect, and then you do that, they decay. There's some process, one way or the other. And that turns out to be very false and predicts huge numbers of decays because the generic pair of brains intersect. And we tried making predictions, and we found very quickly that you go a little distance and everything decays. And it didn't make much sense. And the current belief we have is that, well, what are you looking for? You're looking for that string that you're supposed to turn on. It has to be turned on to get this decay. And you know that in the A picture, you could generate some very general superpotential from world volume, world sheet disk instant time. So really, you would have to check that, W prime, with turning this guy on, has a solution. And that's very hard in the A picture. Okay, but it's exactly this in the B picture. So in the B picture, you had the holomorphic structure already. You did not have to do any world sheet instant time corrections. It was just given to you from whatever the classical or whatever this gauge theory picture was. And it's very clear on the B side. This is exactly what tells you that R can decay into R prime and something else. Maybe I didn't stress that enough, but it's not just some random condition. This is a sub-object. You know, if you degenerate this condition, you gain an extra U1 over here, and this guy will fall apart into this bound state and some other stuff. It might be lots of stuff. It might be one other thing. But in any case, it will include this. And so it's a very natural condition, and we say stated it on the B side, where we can state it classically. So it seems like a very plausible conjecture for the correct stability condition. And then the kicker is that you check. You compute the relation between these zetas and the periods, more or less what I told you here, you know, at linear order, very close to this point. And you compare this condition with that condition, and you find that they agree. So it seems very good. And the reason why I'm telling you that we modified it is we went on to analyze further. And you can also find in the large volume things that satisfy this, well, that do not satisfy this condition, that you're almost certain should exist as objects. So even line bundles are analyzed by other line bundles according to this condition. And it turns out that the reason for that is that there's a real question whether you can actually describe. See, the condition was tantalizingly simple. I wrote the sum of these angles was greater than pi. That's the case where there's no tacking on it, and from this point of view means that it's not stable, actually. And the bound state is not stable. And so you say, well, that thing must be the central charge. But you got this by reversing one of the directions here. And it's actually almost, but not quite, the central charge at this point. And we are really checking now from this geometric point of view, is it possible to formulate a condition just involving the central charge? Okay, so it conceivably will turn out that we'll be able to see just in this geometric picture that you need more than the phase of the central charge. But I still believe, oh, I should have said it. The first check of this thing, of course, is that it reproduced the mu stability. This is to back up a second. And it's actually also quite easy to write out the periods in the large volume limit. So the pi 6 looks something of order t cubed. The pi 4 in the large volume limit in our Clavius is the triple intersection. Put pi 4i, tj, tk. You plug this into this formula, and q4i is exactly this first term class, and you reproduce exactly this condition on the ratios q6 over cij, k, q4i, tj, tk. That comes up in the mu stability. So it turns out to exactly reproduce mu stability in a large volume, as long as the B field is much less than the volume. Okay, so we were very happy we had checked it in all limits and it worked until we started looking at things where B was comparable to the volume. And then this is not literally the same. And I'll just tell you what, if there's a condition that only uses essential charges, what I believe it is, because I'd like to discuss that with people here. So it requires, well, it's deceptively simple to state. Well, this is confusing. Let me say it this way. Arg Okay, so it's really, it looks like the same thing I wrote before, because the imaginary part being positive, of course, means that the argument of the ratio is between 0 and pi. So it's positive as long as you don't get too far from 0. And the difference is that you have to make a sort of universal cover of the phase of the central charge. Okay, and this is actually an idea which is there also in the math literature. It actually goes back to sort of Concevich in some sense, although it hasn't come up in any physics. And so the sort of the problem here, okay, I'll just tell you the problem in two words. Okay, it's clear that when you're on this side and z prime lines up with z, you can have a decay. Okay, but then you come around to you run around in this mz over z prime positive plane, and you can eventually get over here. And the criterion that I first told you that this is a decay also. But this is obviously not a decay because the guys are anti-aligned and the bound, you know, the decay product z minus z prime would be heavier than the other thing. So you cannot allow that. Okay, so very clear, you know, I mean, we just say, well, that and, you know, this. Okay, but now you've wandered off into this negative imaginary part region. And to make total sense of this, you have to say what I'm just about to say, which is that you have to make a universal cover where you keep track of the argument of the essential charges even as it goes past 2 pi, and you distinguish that from 0. And I'm not claiming that that's a different brain. I'm just claiming that there is at least, you at least to check this angle criterion, you at least have to know that. You at least have to know enough to distinguish this from that. And you see, then once you come back to here, what we're saying, so what I just told you is that up here, the bound state is stable. Down here, the bound state is stable. And then you have to know that what you do when you cross this line again is different than what you did before. So you really have to keep track of this. There's the logical conclusion of that proposal. And so an obvious question is, well, does this really make any sort of global sense to say that? And I believe the answer is yes. And there's a concept called graded Lagrangian manifold, which is the dual, which is what the Q's really are, that each Lagrangian manifold carries with it a number that says how many times you did this, which is already in the math literature. So if this makes sense, then this condition that I stated makes sense, and that's the conjecture. But it's not yet clear that there is a condition just depending on the central charges. Anyhow, that's the state of things. So I guess that's a good overview.